From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Good morning. My name is Wanda Best, and I'm one of the New York mothers of the disappeared. My husband signed for a Federal Express package, got 15 years to life.
Today is the 30th anniversary of the Rockefeller drug laws, the most draconian in the country. We'll go from New York to Tallulah to Tulia, Texas. Then, the California Supreme Court rules Nike can be sued for lying, but the ACLU sides with Nike. We'll have a debate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A suicide bomber struck in a nightclub near Tel Aviv yesterday, killing at least 15 Israelis and injuring some 60 others. A second suicide bomber detonated explosives near Haifa today, killing himself but causing no other casualties. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon immediately broke off his visit to the U.S., ironically declaring Israel will not surrender to blackmail. The Palestinian Authority strongly condemned the attack shortly afterward and pledged to take, quote, effective measures against those involved. The statement also said the attacks will arm Sharon with all the excuses to launch this bloody, destructive war against our masses, unquote. Sharon had traveled to Washington on a mission to sideline Yasser Arafat from any future negotiations. Sharon immediately pinned the blame on Palestinian leader. He also said, he who rises up to kill us, we will preempt it and kill him first. Operation Defensive Shield has yielded tremendous achievements, he said, but our work is not done. Israel will fight, Israel will triumph, and when victory prevails, Israel will make peace, unquote. President Bush and Sharon met before the attack. The Washington Post reports they touched only briefly, if at all, on pressing issues, including Sharon's refusal to deal directly with Arafat, ongoing Israeli military operations in the West Bank, and Arab insistence that a timeline be set for statehood talks. Sharon said it was premature to discuss Palestinian statehood and the future of Israeli settlements on Palestinian lands. He also said he would not accept any statehood agreement that called for Israel to withdraw to pre-1967 borders. The London Independent reports the CIA is suspected of a diplomatic blunder that disrupted a deal which would have ended the Israeli army siege of Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity. The deal stalled at the final hurdle after Italy refused to accept a group of Palestinians Israel wants to send into exile there. The Italian government said it had received no formal request to take in the men. An official said the U.S. and Britain were treating Italy in, quote, an arrogant and intolerable manner. Meanwhile, President Bush announced he's dispatching CIA Director George Tenet back to the Middle East to try to establish a new Palestinian security force. International activists say Israel is illegally detaining 5 U.S. and 3 British citizens who tried to bring food to Palestinians trapped inside the church. Most of the activists have gone on hunger strike and are refusing both food and water. 2 of the women have been hospitalized. Some 50 activists took over the Oakland, California Federal Building in one of this country's most dramatic direct actions opposing Israeli occupation of the Palestinian lands. They occupied the building for 4 hours, locked themselves to bright yellow tubes that read, "Unlock Palestine." 17 were arrested. We got a call yesterday from David Solnit as he dangled 20 feet in the air from a banner he hung outside the building.
We're directly out front, support rally, and about 50 people who are occupying the lobby of the U.S. federal building, calling specifically on the U.S. government to end its support for Israel's occupation, no guns to Israel, apply real pressure, and to support just international solutions. And we're trying to break through the facade of the U.S. as being impartial or an advocate of peace in the Middle East as Ariel Sharon meets with the Bush administration today. People inside are negotiating with an FBI agent about what level of a State Department official they're willing to negotiate with and assert our demands. 20 feet in the air in front of the Oakland Federal Building with a giant banner and my climb partner up on a lamppost on the other side, and it's a giant yellow and black banner that says, "No U.S. guns for Israel's occupation, globalized liberation." We had 2 people with ladders, dressed as workmen, throw ladders up to the light posts, and we climbed up them. We have climbing harnesses on, and we tied onto the top of the poles. And then I threw an apple with a rope to my climb partner. She caught it. We pulled the banner across, and it's stretched with rope across the top, and we have it secured to our legs in the bottom, so it's blowing in the wind. It's huge.
David Solnit speaking to us 20 feet above the ground as he and other protesters dangled a banner yesterday in the Oakland Federal Building in one of the country's more dramatic direct actions. This news from Pakistan, a suicide bomber in a car packed with explosives killed 10 French military technicians, a bus driver, and himself today in the southern city of Karachi. The French workers about to leave for a dockyard where they were helping to build two submarines. Suicide bomb attacks are almost unheard of in Pakistan. Last night, gunmen shot dead noted Pakistani Islamic scholar Ghulam Murtaza Malik in Lahore. Meanwhile, Islamic affairs ministers ended a three-day meeting in Malaysia today, saying Islam tolerates no form of terrorism and extremism, and the killing of innocent people, including non-believers, is a sin. U.S. and Canadian forces have taken DNA samples from 24 bodies at a mass grave in Tora Bora to try to discover whether Osama bin Laden and his chief lieutenants were killed there at the end of last year. Here at home, the New York Times reports the Environmental Protection Agency has reversed course and has decided to lead an effort to clean up and test apartments in Lower Manhattan that were polluted by the dust and ash from the World Trade Center. This according to a person who is briefed on the plan. Despite sharp criticism from politicians and residents, the agency has said for months that indoor spaces are the province of owners and residents, not the government. Authorities yesterday arrested a 21-year-old art student from Minnesota in connection with a series of pipe bombs left in rural mailboxes across the Midwest. Lucas John Helder was arrested after a 40-mile chase. The student newspaper at the University of Wisconsin announced it received a 7-page letter signed by Luke Helder that it turned over to the FBI. Helder wrote he was willing to die and threatened to hurt others. The Pentagon's chief financial officer told lawmakers Tuesday the Defense Department has spent more than $12 billion on the so-called war against terrorism since September. Dov Zakim and War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld appeared before the Senate Appropriations Committee, whose chair is charging that lawmakers are being kept in the dark about details of the war's cost. The Appropriations panel hopes to send a new supplemental war funding bill to the full Senate by the end of the week. Rebels in Nepal launched simultaneous attacks today across the country. The army says over 100 soldiers and police officers were killed. The rebel attacks were in retaliation for a massive military attack which left hundreds dead. While the fighting raged, Nepal's Prime Minister, Sher Bahadur Dhuba, met with President Bush in Washington to discuss U.S. aid for Nepal. And President Bush has chosen former President Bill Clinton and Richard Holbrooke, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, to lead a U.S. delegation to East Timor's independence celebrations later this month.
I lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
From annihilation to a new nation, East Timor is born. Join Democracy Now! For live broadcast from East Timor, beginning on May 13th.
Army converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire on the people.
Well, we pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights.
Military assistance programs expose the trainees to democratic ideas and humanitarian standards.
I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor. We have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The California Supreme Court has ruled Nike is liable for deceptive advertising and misleading public statements about labor conditions in the company's factories in Asia. The court declared that Nike and other corporations are not protected by the First Amendment when they make false statements about their labor policies or company operations in ads, press releases, or public statements. Nike became a major target of labor and global justice campaigners in the mid-90s. In 1996, CorpWatch got a hold of Nike's own audit of a factory in Vietnam, which showed that workers were exposed to toxic chemicals without protection or safety training and were forced to work illegal excess overtime. The The story found its way to the front page of the New York Times. Nike responded with a wide-ranging public relations campaign. It hired Good Works International, a consultancy firm owned by former UN Ambassador Andrew Young. And they hired Good Works to audit some of its factories. Nike then advertised Good Works' more favorable conclusions in full-page newspaper ads and letters to university presidents and athletic directors. California environmental activist Mark Caskey sued Nike in 1998 for false advertising. The ACLU filed briefs in support of Nike. We're joined right now by ACLU staff attorney Anne Brick and Medea Benjamin, who is the founding director of Global Exchange. Anne Brick, let's begin with you. Why did you defend Nike in this case?
The issue in this case is whether or not Nike's statements were commercial speech, that is, advertising, the way you and I normally think of it, or part of a public debate that's entitled to full First Amendment protection. Their statements were contained in, for example, a letter to the editor of the New York Times in response to one of a series of columns that Bob Herbert had written that, of course, were highly critical of Nike's practices. There were two letters, one to the CEO of the YWCA and another letter to the head of a human rights organization. There were letters to university presidents and athletic directors explaining Nike's side of the debate, and there were a series of press releases. What there weren't were ordinary advertisements, an in-store poster, for example, or a label on a sweatshirt. And so the issue here for us was, do we give less protection under the First Amendment to Nike's side of the debate than to the other side of the debate, which is taking place in the newspapers across the country, on radio shows, and on television programs? We saw this as a public debate on an important public issue. And when statements are made in that context, both sides are entitled to full First Amendment protection.
Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange, your response.
With all due respect, Anne, I find that position ridiculous. The purpose of Nike putting out those statements or letters to the editor or press releases is for profit. And as the Supreme Court rightly ruled in California, that is commercial speech. If a company is talking about the conditions of workers in the factories that make its shoes, it has an obligation to tell the truth. Now, like Nike can still lie about all kinds of things related to larger issues. It can talk about globalization being good for the poor. It can say there's no such thing as global warming. It could say China's a democracy. George Bush is a profound thinker. It could say all those things, and that's covered by free speech. But when it talks about issues related to its factories with the purpose of increasing its sales and profits, that is commercial speech, and it should be true.
Anne Brick.
What you're saying here is we have a debate going on in the newspapers, on television, about the conditions under which Nike products are being made abroad. One side of the debate gets absolute full First Amendment protection, as we always think of it, and of course it should. But the other side of the debate, the Nike side of the debate, because Nike has an economic interest in the debate, is not entitled to full First Amendment protection. And, of course, you have to remember that there are economic interests on both sides of the debate.
I have no economic interest in saying that Nike underpays its workers, overwork its workers, has hit them with shoes when they didn't work fast enough, has used underage children in its factories. I have absolutely no economic interest. Nike has access to a lot more information than I have. Nike, when we started our campaign, never allowed us into the factories. And so they would put out reports saying, we pay workers twice the minimum wage in Indonesia. And we'd say, no, that's not true. Now, Nike knew it was lying, has access to the records of the factories. Why should they get away with lying? It's just like saying a car company that says, oh, we care about the environment, and so our cars, we put out cars that get 50 miles an hour, when they know the cars only get 30 miles an hour. That's false advertising. It's illegal. This is the exact same thing.
Anne Brick, what makes it different?
What makes this different is the context in which the debate is taking place. These are not ads aimed solely at consumers. These are public statements responding to attacks on the company, and they're taking place in a much broader context. Sure, consumers are always part of a general audience, but that doesn't turn a statement into commercial speech. That audience was composed not only of consumers who might or might not buy Nike products, it was composed of the whole universe of people who read the newspapers, who listen to the radio, who watch TV, who are going to be forming an opinion on this debate about who's right and who's wrong.
Well, all the more reason that those people should get the truth. This is also saying that companies are allowed to lie who they ever they want to lie to. In the face of attacks against them, threats of a boycott, Nike put out this stuff to say that what we were putting out was not true. The fact of the matter is Nike was lying. Customers want the truth. People who read the newspaper want companies to tell the truth. Other companies that are trying to get a commercial advantage by not exploiting their workers want companies to tell the truth. I think it's a sad day when the ACLU is defending the rights of a corporation to lie instead of saying corporations are not people. They should not have the same rights of free speech because they do have commercial interests that the rest of us don't. And I think as the court came out with a very positive ruling, that ACLU should rethink its defense of corporations to lie.
Let's be very clear about one thing. What this case is about is the right to speak. The First Amendment here is very important because it protects not just Nike's right to speak. It protects my right to speak, your right to speak, the right of a labor union in a labor dispute to speak without the fear of being hauled into court and having to take part in extremely expensive litigation to prove the truth or falsity of its claims. Because when you get hauled into court, it is expensive, and it makes you think twice about what you say, whether you're a labor union or an individual or a corporation. You are not going to take part in the public debate about an issue of public concern. That's what this case is all about, is making sure that we, the listeners, get to hear both sides of the debate and then get to make up our minds. Surely, if we trust the general public to make up its mind about who's telling the truth and who we should believe in a political campaign, which, of course, is the heart of the First Amendment, we have to give that same credit to people to be able to evaluate both sides of the debate, because there are two sides of the debate being heard here. Your side was being heard loud and clear with full First Amendment protection. What this case is about is letting the other side of the debate also be able to be heard with full protection. And then we let the people, not the government,
decide. I'm sorry, but
Anne,
having fought against Nike for years, it's quite humorous to hear you act like a small nonprofit organization like Global Exchange has the same ability to reach the public as Nike does and has the same interests in mind. First of all, we do not have the billion-dollar budgets that Nike has to put out these materials. And second of all, we don't have the commercial interests that Nike has. I think the public deserves to hear corporations tell the truth. This is not about Nike's ability to talk about issues around globalization or workers' rights in general or democracy or any of those issues that have come before the public. This is about whether Nike has to tell the truth about how its products are made. I think that the majority of people who heard this case came out ruling on our side, saying that this is, of course, commercial speech. Whenever Nike was putting out press releases, it was to counter a campaign against them so they could increase their sales and increase their profits. It wasn't about Phil Knight just having a chance to give his philosophical views on the global economy. So that's why this is not free speech. This is commercial speech. I think it's a positive ruling. I think it's something that the public wants, the consumers want, and I would say it's something that other companies want because they don't want to be put in unfair competition with a company that is allowed to lie to the public about the conditions in which its products are made.
We're talking to Medea Benjamin, founding director of Global Exchange, and Anne Brick. I know you want to respond, staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. Anne Brick.
What this is really about is about the public being able to hear both sides of the debate loud and clear. You might be interested to know that Bob Herbert, who wrote a series of scathing columns, really taking Nike to task. He'd obviously gotten involved in the issue. He cared about the issue in the same way that Global Exchange cares about it. And in fact, it was one of his columns that caused Nike to write a letter to the editor of the New York Times that led to this lawsuit. And even Bob Herbert said, as much as I don't like Nike, Nike has got to have the right to respond in a public debate. I really would prefer if you didn't interrupt me. I was careful not to interrupt you. Bob Herbert understands that everybody's First Amendment rights are at stake, both as speakers and as an audience. When we only allow one side of the debate full protection and say to the other debate, you have to give your point of view under a different set of rules. What this is really about is letting everybody play by the same set of rules under the First Amendment that keeps us all free.
Man, can I ask you a question? What if a clothing company came out and said, I pay my workers anywhere in the world a U.S. minimum wage, and they put it out in a press release?
What you have to look at
That's a blatant lie, okay? Should that company be liable for what it said?
You always have to look at the context in which a statement is made.
It was made in the context of groups like mine saying, you pay your workers miserable wages that don't allow them to lift themselves out of poverty. And the company comes back and says, that's not true. We pay our workers the same minimum wage as they do in the United States.
Suppose, Medea, that you're on the stage of the audience, or you're on this radio show. You're making your statements about Nike. Nike is responding to your statements with their statements. Are we going to say what you say is entitled to the full protection of the First Amendment, but what Nike says isn't?
Of course, and that's what the California Supreme Court came and said, that a company has a commercial interest. If I say these poor workers who work in your factories are being treated miserably like indentured servants, and Nike says, not true, we're paying the U.S. minimum wage. Now, I'm not saying Nike said this. I'm saying if they did, a blatant lie that everybody knows isn't true, should Nike be liable? Of course they should, because that's commercial speech.
I'm going to have to interrupt here because we have to go to break. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Medea Benjamin, founding director of Global Exchange, and Anne Brick, staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at what this beginning of the 30th year of the Rockefeller drug laws means in New York. Then we'll travel the country and look at drug laws in other places. Stay with us.
Every ghetto, every city, and suburban place I've been, make me recall my days in the New Jerusalem. Story starts in Hooterville. Grew up next to Ivy Hill when kids were stealing quarter bills for fun. Killed a guy and caught a paw. Rode a mongoose till it's dark. Watching kids show off the stolen ones. Every ghetto, every city, and suburban place I've been make me recall my days in the New Jerusalem. You know it's hot, don't forget what you got. Looking back.
Every ghetto, every city, from the miseducation of Lauryn Hill, here on Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, today marks the beginning of the 30th year of the New York State Rockefeller drug laws, some of the harshest anti-drug laws in the country. They were pushed through the New York legislature in 1973 by then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller. The laws require a minimum sentence of 15 years for minor possession of drugs. The laws mostly result in the imprisonment of first-time, low-level drug offenders. Most are poor, most are people of color. Today, hundreds of New Yorkers will gather outside Governor Mataki's office to demand that he, quote, drop the rock and overturn the Rockefeller drug laws. Among those who will be speaking is the Reverend Al Sharpton. He'll be joining us in a few minutes. But first, we go to Wanda Best. Wanda, you have become part of a group called the Mothers of the Disappeared. Perhaps an unwilling member because of your own story. Can you tell us what happened to your husband?
Well, I have four daughters, and my oldest daughter was in Hunter College. And although she got financial aid, her books were extra. So my husband, not wanting to ask for anything, he went up to his uncle's house and was going to do some repair work on the awning to make a little bit of extra money. While he was there, a Federal Express truck pulled up. The man came upstairs. My husband, needing glasses but not being able to afford glasses, he looked at the package. The address was the address of my uncle's house, but the name seemed to be the name of the next-door neighbor. So my husband signed, and the Federal Express guy walked down the stairs, and when my husband took a closer look, he realized that's not the right name. He went down the stairs to hand the package back, and then the police grabbed him. And the rest is history.
Well, why? What was in the package?
Cocaine.
He was giving the package back to FedEx. Had he opened it?
He was attempting to. No, he didn't open it.
And was the FedEx driver a cop?
Yes, he was. It's our belief that the Federal Express guy would have, if my uncle has two dogs, if the dogs would have signed for the package, they would have arrested the dogs. They were not concerned whatsoever who the package was intended for. They just wanted whoever received the package. And at my husband's hearing, at his trial, his defense attorney asked, well, did you try to find out where the drugs came from? They weren't interested. They couldn't care less who had all these drugs, who was transporting them. They just was looking for a scapegoat.
So what happened? What was he sentenced? He was found guilty?
Yes. And he was sentenced to 15 years to life.
What did the judge say?
At his sentencing, the judge said that he wished that there was something that he could do, that he knew that the punishment far outweighed the crime, but that his hands were tied by the Rockefeller drug law, and that there was nothing he could do but sentence him to the very minimum, which is 15 years to life.
So he's now, it's been 2 years, and he's where?
Well, he wasn't convicted until October 23rd of 2001. And he's now at Eastern Correctional Facility in upstate New York. He was at Clinton, which is 50 miles from Canada. And when my husband was there, we had no form of communication at all. It was 2 weeks before I could even get a letter from him.
Elaine Bartlett, you're one of the founders of the Mothers of the Disappeared. Is this a typical story?
Yes, it is. It's a very typical story. And so many people are affected by the Rockefeller drug laws. And the greatest impact is the fact that the kids suffer more, the family members that are left behind, as well as the person becoming incarcerated.
What about your story?
My story, in 1984, I was convicted of selling 4 ounces of cocaine. I was sentenced to 20 to life. Fortunately, I was able to receive clemency after doing 16 years of that 20 life sentence. My husband, Nathan Brooks, is still incarcerated in Green Haven Correctional Facility. He is serving a sentence of 25 to life.
And did you sell the 4 ounces of cocaine?
I agreed to deliver a package for a friend, and he used me to get his own self out of being locked up because he had several records. He's been arrested, and he never did time. So he used me to deliver the package, and he made it seem like I was going to Albany to open up shop and a kingpin or a king queen. When I got arrested, I was living in Wagner Projects. I was paying $127 a month rent, and I had $5 in my pocket when I got arrested.
You got clemency from the current governor, Governor Pataki?
Yes, Governor Pataki.
After serving?
16 years of a 20-life sentence. Hmm.
Randy Credico is also with us, director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. You have been spearheading these protests against the Rockefeller drug laws. Seems to me a few years ago that when Governor Pataki gave his State of the State address that in Albany, he said he was going to overturn these laws. What happened?
Well, he said that 8 years ago when he was elected. He said, I can't believe all these people are in prison on minor drug charges. He said it last year. Then the district attorneys, state of New York, which 99% are white, where 95% of the people in prison on the drug charges are black or Latino, put the pressure on them, the district attorneys, and so he folded, and nothing happened, nothing but gridlock last year. He said it again on January 9th when the Mothers of New York Disappeared went up to Albany and had a press conference. He said, let's get rid of the Rockefeller drug laws or let's amend it. But the thing is, what he's proposing is one step forward and like nine steps backwards. He wants to increase the penalties for marijuana use up to 3 to 5 years in prison. So it's like a poison pill. No one's going to support his bill for change. And what happened? What happened is nothing right now. Although I think he is very fearful that this is the one area where he's vulnerable because he's dependent on votes in the Latino community. That's the reason why he went down and gave lip service on the Vieques issue. But Latinos are heavily, heavily affected by this. There are 10,000 Latinos in prison on minor drug charges in the state of New York. We do not have Pablo Escobars. They're like Daryl Best or Elaine Bartlett. I think the Latino community is smart enough to know if he really wanted to help out Latinos, he would amend the Rockefeller drug laws. That's one thing he can do. He cannot get the president to change policy on Vieques, but he can change it because he's the governor of the state of New York and he has a lot of sway with the state Senate, and that's what's holding this back.
So, Elaine Bartlett, you're going to be up at 40th Street and 3rd Avenue in New York at noon, which is the office of Governor George Pataki, yet he's the man who granted you clemency.
Yes, I am. He granted me clemency, which I'm very grateful for, but that's not enough. And out of everybody that's incarcerated, the chances of getting clemency is very slim. You have to sell yourself. You have to sell your family. So not only do you put them through a lot being incarcerated for the 16 years, then you have to exploit everybody and get interviews and make everything public. So it causes more damage than good to the family members because then if they were saying that you was away at school, now it becomes public knowledge and everybody knows that your mother was in prison for 16 years for drugs. And clemency is great, but once we come back out into society, we're still dealing with another prison outside because regardless to what we have done while we're incarcerated, it's not looked at. And when we come out, we still have a struggle out here that goes on. We can't get housing because of the New York State laws that they pass, where if you have a felony conviction, you can't even live in a housing project apartment. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing that we're able to afford once we come out of prison. The jobs that we're able to obtain, they're low-income jobs. And the most that we might be making on a job is $18,000 a year. So that's not really giving us enough help to reunite with our families and get back together. So the struggle goes on.
I remember visiting you, Elaine Bartlett, at Bedford Hills when you were in prison. There were a number of women there, clearly leaders at the Bedford Hills prison, who had been there for 15, 18, 20 years on cases like yours. How do women organize inside the prison?
Basically, how we try to organize, we try to get our families to get involved with the Mothers of the Disappeared on the outside.
Why that title, Mothers of the Disappeared?
Because once you lock us up, we are disappeared. As far as our children go and our loved ones, we are no longer in their lives. And even though they come and see us, that's not enough. And to them, we're disappeared. We disappeared away from them because when you tell a child that you're going to be locked away for 20 years to life, 20 years is like committing suicide to that child. You know, my experiences as well as other mothers, my daughter talked about committing suicide. I had one son that followed me and he became incarcerated. He did 6 years under a drug case. So not only did me and my husband go to jail, I had a son that went to jail. My other son, basketball saved him, so that was fortunate. But even coming home, it's hard to rebuild them years, and you can't get them back. And I think that when the judges sit on the jury and the panels, they don't realize that when you tell somebody that they're going to be going away for 20 years, they don't realize the impact that it has on everybody.
Wanda Best, what's happened to your family since your husband was put away?
It's all I can do to keep them together. I have four daughters, and I live in a housing project. And it's very difficult.
How old are they?
I have a 13-year-old, a 15-year-old. My 17-year-old daughter is her senior prom today, and I should be home with her trying to help her get ready for her prom. But instead, I'm fighting for her father's life. My 20-year-old daughter, she plays college basketball. And my husband lived all this time waiting to see his daughter play college basketball. And now he can't. My 17-year-old daughter's getting ready to go away to college. And my husband won't be there. It's just very difficult.
Again, if you've just joined us, Wanda Best's husband was sentenced to 15 years by a reluctant judge because the Rockefeller drug laws in New York are mandatory drug laws. He received a FedEx package signed for it, and as Wanda describes it, when he saw it wasn't for his uncle where he was, he went back to the FedEx truck to return it, and there he was arrested. The FedEx driver was a police officer. On the telephone right now is the Reverend Al Sharpton. He is going to be speaking at today's protest on this beginning of the 30th year of the Rockefeller drug laws. Welcome to Democracy Now, Reverend Sharpton.
Good morning.
As we listen to the stories of Wanda Best and her husband, Daryl Best, Elaine Bartlett, having spent 16 years before she got clemency from Governor Pataki, why are you going out today outside the governor's office?
Well, I think that this is a continuation of one of the worst forms of judicial misconduct and oppressive legislation that we've ever seen. And I think that clearly, for people to give lip service in terms of Governor Pataki and others, that this must be dealt with. But no one really are doing anything to repeal these laws and to stop the continued enforcement of the laws, because there are people incarcerated right now under those laws that have not been freed and have not even had their cases reviewed. It warrants our continued protest. It warrants our continued moral outrage. It warrants our public indignation. So I'm proudly joining other activists from around the state and, for that matter, the tri-state area in front of the governor's office at noon today, because I think that this is something that will not go away by itself. We must keep the pressure on, because it is clearly something that has violated the rights of people in the state of New York.
Reverend Sharpton, on Super Bowl Sunday, there were these ads during the football games, I guess the most watched ads in the United States, that equated the war on terrorism with the war on drugs and talked about people here at home, if caught in the drug dragnet, as terrorists here.
I think that what we are seeing is a real attempt to set a climate of McCarthyism in this country. If you question Bush policy, you're pro-terrorist. If you have, if they can put a drug straitjacket on you, you're a terrorist. We're dealing with a case in Brooklyn now where a man never arrested of drugs, don't know that he was engaged in drug trafficking, but it's all right to shoot him in the back in the name of we were going for a drug bust. We must be very careful that, first of all, I'm against drugs. I fight drug dealing, and I am no way I'm soft on that area. But I am also just as adamantly opposed to them misusing that as a way to justify the robbery or erosion of civil liberties and civil rights for citizens in this country. And I think that is what the Bush-Ashcroft axis is trying to do.
Reverend Sharpton, right now, as you were talking about the pressure on people here at home around the issue of speaking out, your thoughts right now on, as we move into the 30th anniversary of the Rockefeller drug laws, what exactly Governor Pataki could do in New York. But it's not only New York, though. These are among the harshest laws in the country. What exactly should be done?
Well, I think that the laws must be repealed. In New York, it's Rockefeller drug laws, but Amy, you're right. All over the country, these laws must be repealed. And what a governor like Pataki could do is stand up and oppose them, stand up and say that we're going to put a moratorium on their use. A Republican governor put a moratorium on the use of the death penalty in Illinois. There's been no real moral initiative, no concrete or tangible stand given in this regard. There's been some modified lip service, but no real action. And I think that particularly in New York, where there is a gubernatorial race this year, in Texas, where there are races, where there are real races, real disciplined and insightful activists must make these the front burner issues. We should not allow them to continue to reduce American politics to who smiles the brightest, who speaks the best, and who may be the next Bill Clinton or whoever else we're going to use. We must make these hardcore, fundamental, basic issues the main issues of these races. And I hope today's demonstration will begin to make these archaic laws in New York one of the centerpiece issues of the gubernatorial race for the year 2002 in New York, and I hope others do that in major state races and congressional races around the country.
Are you going to run for public office?
I've not decided. I have an exploratory committee. We're looking at 2004. I think that clearly there has been over the last decade a very dramatic and open move to the right by the Democratic Party. They say center. I say center of right. And I think there must be a viable but winnable campaign to try and bring this country back to dealing with civil liberties and civil rights and a humane health care system, and to deal in a foreign policy that is balanced, that leads toward world peace rather than domination. And if after we have gone through this exploratory phase, we feel we can build the infrastructure to mount that type of winning campaign, then we will do it. Dr. Cornel West and Charles Ogletree and others are on the exploratory committee with some elected officials around the country, and we're deliberating very seriously about this. When I see what is going on in the Bush administration and the lack of real challenge from the Democratic Party, it makes me even more wanting to do it, but I don't want to just make a passionate run. I want to make a viable run if I do make the run at all.
And that's a run for President of the United States.
That's correct.
I want to thank you for being with us, Reverend Al Sharpton. We'll be hearing your speech later today at 40th and 3rd in Manhattan outside of Governor Pataki's office. And I want to thank our guests who have joined us. We've been speaking with Wanda Best and Elaine Bartlett, part of the Mothers of the Disappeared, and Randy Credico, who's director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Contact information, website,
yes,
phone number?
www.kunstler.org, KUNSTLER.org. Mothers of the Disappeared, their number is 212-539-8441. That's Mothers of the New York Disappeared. Obviously, they were inspired by the mothers in Argentina.
When we come back, we're going to go to Tulia, Texas. We'll be speaking with Tanya White, who was just acquitted in a drug case. 10% of the black population of Tulia, Texas, were arrested in a drug sting operation. Tanya White will be joined by her attorney, Jeff Blackburn. Stay with us.
Sisters, brothers and the whitest. No one is willing, kinda make you get that feeling.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, that from the soundtrack of Dead Presidents. I'm Amy Goodman. We talked about New York. Now we're going to Tulsa, Texas, and quite amazing story that has developed over the last few years. Jeff Blackburn, you're an attorney actually in Houston. Not Houston?
No, in Amarillo.
In Amarillo. And got involved in this case. Can you talk about it? We're not just talking one case.
Well, we're talking about a process that put a tenth of the black population of a small town in prison, basically, or convicted. Lots and lots of bad lawyers, court-appointed Texas kind of lawyers, a Texas system that's been so well-regarded all over the world for what it is and how it works, went to work on this population. Crooked cop who lied his way into getting convictions on all these folks. And finally, after some national attention got focused, primarily by the Kunstler Fund, on what was going on there, we began to assemble a legal team, and now we're working real hard on doing those convictions. And we started with Ms. White's case.
Tanya White, can you describe what happened a couple years ago with a large group, scores of African Americans in Tulsa, Texas?
Well, I was living in Oklahoma City at the time. And I really didn't know, so I moved from Oklahoma to Shreveport. And my mom called me one day and told me that they just came through and locked up two of my brothers and my sister. And she told me, well, she said, I seen your picture. And I was like, my picture? And so this is like 2 months later that, you know, she told me about my picture that they had seen up there too. And I'm like, well, I ain't never sold no drugs, so I don't know what's really, you know, going on. So I just stayed away for 2 years until Jeff Blackburn got in touch with me, and everything from there, you know, we started working hard on it, and I know I didn't do it, you know, I was like, well, I'm going to spend 99 of life for something I didn't do, and so it's been a hard 3 years, you know, but I made it through.
Now, but I want to understand what happened early this morning when everyone was arrested. What day was it? What in Tulsa? Jeff, maybe you could talk about this.
July 23rd, 2 years ago, they indicted 142 different cases, 46 different people, and made a mass arrest of all of these folks in the town. Rounded them up and brought
early
them to the
courthouse. In the morning.
Early in the morning. Unfortunately for Tanya, she wasn't there because she didn't live there anymore. And the other defendant, who still remains to go to trial, a woman named Zuri Bossett, mm-hmm. who had also moved away.
And the officer who did this so-called sting operation named Tom Coleman?
Tom Coleman. One man, and his word alone, led to all those indictments.
Wire? Did he have a wire?
No. His word alone, no
photographs. And his word was that each person was somehow involved in buying or selling drugs.
Right.
So, Tanya White, you went to trial a couple weeks ago, is that right? Or you were about to go to trial.
Yeah, about to go to trial.
What happened?
Well, I was on the 1st of April, we went to another pretrial. And like I said, they throwing everything out. And I was like, oh, Lord. You know, after they started throwing everything out, I was like, well, I don't have no chance there. But I still had a lot of faith. And then, I guess, 6 days before, they called me in Shreveport and said that they found the bank records, that I had withdrawn $8 a day that he said I sold him drugs. And the next day they had a...
But why is that significant? You withdrew $8 where?
In Oklahoma City the day that he said I sold drugs.
That Tom Coleman said you sold drugs where?
In Tulsa, Texas.
And how far away is that from Oklahoma City?
5.5-hour drive.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So once you had that bank record,
mm-hmm.
that proved you weren't there.
Exactly.
And Chris Hoffman, you're also with the legal defense team. What does this mean? Not only for, well, Tanya White's case has been thrown out now. Does that mean, well, how many people have been put in prison at this point? And does it mean one by one these cases will be reviewed?
Well, I think certainly it calls into question the entire operation. Now there's some affirmative evidence that he did, in fact, lie. About one of these, and that's not something that we had before. I mean, we've always suspected. There's been a lot of evidence to indicate that he's been described as a pathological liar. But now there's proof, and with that proof, we intend to start knocking these down like dominoes. Basically, the remaining trial, Zuri Bossett, who we've talked about, we think that Tanya's case is going to be very relevant in that trial for purposes of showing what kind of character this guy has, what he was willing to do, and so it's a very significant...
What kind of character? I mean, he has become rather notorious, but what was his own story, his own record?
Well, at the time that Tom Coleman was hired for this job, he was actually out of law enforcement. He had been a deputy sheriff and a jailer. He was the only person to answer the ad they put in the paper for this job. And without really checking out who he was, they gave him the job.
And what was the job?
Basically, to be an undercover officer in Swisher County and Tulia specifically over a period of time. I believe it was about 9 months to a year. They gave him some minimal training and set him loose.
Jeff Blackburn, what is some examples of some of the sentences that were meted out to people?
Absolutely outrageous. And understand, too, in Texas we have jury sentences. Most of these folks early on went to juries to give them their punishment. It doesn't work that way in most other states. But it's very important because it shows what's really at work here. It's a racist process. It's a process where you have all white jurors in a small town who have very, very clear attitudes, very ugly attitudes towards black people. And they get to let those attitudes run rampant when they get somebody accused in front of them. So we wound up with 99-year sentences, 320-year sentences, 75 years. Tanya White's family alone, she has a brother who got 60 years, a sister who got 25 years.
How old are your brother and sister?
26 and 25.
How old are you?
33.
Do you think your sister and brother's case could be turned around? No?
Oh, yeah, if we fight hard enough, and it'll be turned around.
I wanted to end today's program by going from Tulia, Texas to Tallulah, Louisiana. Family and friends of Louisiana's child prisoners descended on the state capitol there yesterday to demand the Tallulah Youth Prison be closed down. Tallulah is the most notorious juvenile prison in a state known for its brutal juvenile prisons. About three-quarters of the kids who are in this prison are nonviolent, some accused of being involved with drugs, others not. But just as we talk about the criminal justice system in this country, David Utter has joined us on the line, director of the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
We're talking about what happens to people, how they get into prison. What happens in prison, particularly in Tallulah, why people were protesting yesterday?
Well, Tallulah is only symbolic of what's going on in all of Louisiana's juvenile prisons. Not only do we over-incarcerate, but when a child gets into one of these facilities, they are subjected to random violence by both guards and other kids, and there's just little to no therapy really happening for these kids.
And so who gathered outside the prison yesterday?
Well, it was the family and friends of Louisiana's incarcerated children, a group called FLIC, that is a grassroots organization really started by parents of incarcerated kids. And they've been joined by various community folks who are concerned about this issue as well. And they just have, I guess for about a year now, been organized on this issue and have been pushing Louisiana to do right by its kids.
Is Louisiana unusual in its treatment of kids in jail?
It's, I really don't know. I mean, I don't know what's happening around the rest of the country on this issue. I sense that it is not that unusual, but we do, as in many things that are, related to race and class, we do stand out particularly ignobly on this issue.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, David Utter, Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana. Tanya White, you're not in prison.
No.
You got out with the evidence that actually took a few years to get. Is that right? You could have ended up in jail. A lot of the people we're talking about had evidence even flimsier than yours. They just didn't have to happen to have a bank account in Oklahoma to prove they were sitting in a bank or walking into a bank at the time supposedly a drug deal was being made. What are you doing now outside the prison in organizing for people who are inside? You're here in New York.
Yeah, I'm New York. Well, I want to start something, you know, help out with the women of the disappearing, the mothers of the disappearing and different stuff. And, like, I never knew nothing about this in Tallulah, Louisiana. I'm not too far from there. And I just want to get involved and, you know, and help get the other people out because, you know, people just in there for nothing. We get criminal, I mean, drug offenders get more time than murderers does, you know, and that's not right. You know, we need to do something to get these people out, and just these laws are, need to turn the laws over, that's all.
Have the sting, the drug sting in Tulia changed Tulia, Texas?
It was a ghost town when I was living there before. It's really a ghost town now because, you know, it's not that many people, you know, young teenagers there. It's not that many people there now.
Jeff Blackburn, if people want to get in touch with the defense team, where can they call?
We found that the best press agent we could ever have is Randy Credico and the Kunstler Fund. What they should do is get in touch with them through their website. They've been real good to us, and they've helped us a great deal.
Well, we'll have all that information on our website. Chris Hoffman, Jeff Blackburn, Tanya White, thanks for joining us. Our website is www.democracynow.org. I am headed off today, flying to East Timor over the next 2 days. Juan Gonzalez will be hosting tomorrow and Friday. And starting Monday, we'll be doing historic broadcasts from Dili, East Timor. On May 20th, May 19th, our time in the United States, a historic event, and that is the founding of a new nation. The people of East Timor, for a quarter of a century, occupied by the Indonesian military, a third of the population killed there, but they continued to resist. And they have prevailed at a very high price, and there are major celebrations that will be going on in that tiny island nation over this next few weeks. We will be doing the broadcast live starting on Monday from East Timor, and we hope you'll all join us and let others know about the broadcasts from annihilation to a new nation. East Timor is born. And you can get more information on our website at democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. You can also email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We're broadcasting from downtown community television, blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! Blacks and the crackers, police and their backers, they're all political. Hell.